Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, March Madness is upon us and the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio wants to remind Central Ohio residents about resources available for those who are concerned about their sports betting. Jay Fox will talk to a doctor about the prevalence of colorectal cancer in Columbus, and he'll chat with an expert from the solar energy industry. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month, and the amount of legal betting on March Madness is expected to top $3 billion this year. Here in Ohio, nearly one in five Ohioans are at risk for problem gambling. That's 1.8 million people. In response, the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network was recently launched so that any Ohioan can have access to qualified counselors specifically geared toward Ohioans with gambling problem concerns. Here to talk about the issue is Executive Director of the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio, Derek Longmire. Welcome to Columbus Perspective, Derek.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get started. Tell us about the Problem Gambling Network and the work that you do and the new Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network.
Thank you. We are an organization that started in the 1980s and really focus on workforce development for prevention professionals as well as clinicians that are working in the area of gambling support services. And most recently, we've launched the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network. And what OGTN is an opportunity through teletherapy for all Ohioans to have access to care. As we were looking at kind of starting out, we knew that less than half of Ohio counties had someone qualified to treat gambling in county. So OGTN is that safety net for those individuals that live in those what we call gambling treatment deserts.
Well, as I mentioned, March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month. What can you tell us about the statistics of problem gambling here in Ohio?
Based on the most recent survey that was conducted in 2022, one in five Ohio adults are at risk for developing a gambling problem. And it's important to note that that was done prior to sports betting. And we know just with calls to the Ohio Problem Gambling Helpline and looking at the number of individuals reaching out for gambling support, that we expect those numbers to continue to climb.
Now, you've mentioned the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network, and we're just wondering, are there any other states that offer similar programs, or is this unique to Ohio?
This is unique to Ohio, and we're the first in the nation to offer statewide teletherapy for gambling, and it's something that we're really proud of. Again, looking at the desert areas that we see with access to care from a local perspective, this is really an important tool and resource available to all Ohioans that may be experiencing gambling-related harm, being both the individual gambler as well as their loved ones.
Derek Longmire is the executive director of the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio. It is Problem Gambling Awareness Month, and that coincides nicely with March Madness. So someone listening right now that says, I may have a concern here. How would they go about accessing the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network?
The first spot is to go to our website, and we try to make it as simple as possible, and that's ohiogtn.org for the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network. And from there, there's a variety of resources available. You can also call our phone number and get access to services there, or by calling the Ohio Problem Gambling Helpline, and that number is 1-800-589-9966. So we like to say, there's no wrong door. We're here to help in whatever manner you come to us.
Derek, can you talk a little bit about the link between disordered gambling and mental health issues, including suicide?
Certainly, as we look at those markers that make someone at increased risk for developing a gambling problem or disordered gambling, we see a lot of correlation between both substance use disorders as well as mental health disorders. Additionally, if someone has a family history of someone in their family who has a gambling problem or other substance use mental health disorders, they're exponentially more likely to be at risk or develop a gambling problem than those that don't have those life experiences.
And Derek, what are some of the signs that someone may be experiencing problem or disordered gambling?
The easiest sign for an individual is just to ask yourself, is this still fun? And if it's not, then that certainly is a big warning sign, because really looking at betting as an entertainment activity. Also really looking at setting limits and being able to stick to those limits. So that's limits of both dollars spent as well as time spent. So if you're looking at your budget and you say, I can dedicate, say, $20 a week to sports betting, for instance, or watching March Madness, and I'm only going to bet while I'm watching a game, then those are those limits to set, assuming that you can afford that. But if you go past that time spent or those dollars spent, then those are important warning signs to be mindful of.
And can you tell us a little bit more about resources available for people that are concerned about a loved one's or perhaps their own gambling?
Certainly. Of course, we have the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network that we spoke about and the resources that are available through ohiogtn.org. We have resources for both the individual gambler as well as their loved one. And we know that the path to support and help looks different for everyone. So some of those resources could be individual counseling through organizations like OGTN, could also be group counseling. We could look at financial support as well as other self-help groups like Gamblers Anonymous. So the path to support looks different and is really up to the caller in determining what they're looking for. And that's where our navigators help with ensuring that the right resources are available for the individual and what they're looking for.
And even before getting in touch with someone at this resource, you could also take a quiz online to rate your risk of problem or disordered gambling. That's at pausebeforeyouplay.org. And there's also healthy tips at pausebeforeyouplay.org to gamble responsibly. Great resources from the Problem Gambling Network of Ohio and the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network. $3 billion or more being bet on March Madness. There's a lot of noise out there around sports betting, specifically here in Ohio. And we're so grateful that the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network is now available. Derek Longmire, I thank you so much for your time today and for all of the great information that you've shared.
Thank you.
For more information about the Ohio Gambling Telehealth Network, please visit ohiogtn.org. If you or a loved one needs help, please call the Ohio Problem Gambling Helpline at 1-800-589-9966.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
In Central Ohio, colon and rectum cancer accounted for 7.5% of all new invasive cancers, according to a recent study. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and new concerns about the disease impacting younger adults have prompted new initiatives for screenings and lifestyle changes. Dr. Nancy Yu joins us now on Columbus Perspective from the American College of Surgeons. Welcome, Nancy.
Good morning.
With 1 in 10 colorectal cancer patients being under 50 and an alarming number of people being in their 20s and 30s, what is causing the younger generation to be more susceptible now?
This is the million-dollar question that is out there. What we know is that the incidence is rising, that people that are, who are born in the 1990s have doubled the risk of colon cancer and quadrupled the risk of rectal cancer compared to those who were born in the 1950s. There's a lot of active research to identify contributing factors. Some of them, we think, are related to genetic reasons, environmental changes, maybe some dietary pattern shifts, and lifestyle factors.
So how much of it is related to diet versus the environment and versus changes in DNA? For example, concerns about eating too much bacon as a potential carcinogen. Does that fall into play more, or is it just all of the above?
Yeah, great question, too. Cancer is complex, and it's heterogeneous, meaning that one person's cancer is probably different from another one's. So it's actually difficult to give an exact answer to your question, but what we do know is that all the different factors act together. And so I think it's all of the above, but, you know, we really think the focus is on wellness and taking care of yourself, and that relates to dietary choices, regular exercise, other lifestyle modifications. We know red meat and bacon is related to colorectal cancer and is related to gut health. So we do want to make choices in terms of foods that help gut health.
Well, and screening is a major factor in determining, you know, what the possibilities are. But the question is, at what age should we begin the process? Because it used to be not until you're over 50.
That's right. I always start talking about screening by distinguishing screening from diagnosis. So screening refers to checking a person who has no symptoms, whereas diagnosis is when someone has a symptom and needs to get checked out. The dialogue nationwide has been about what age to start screening. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. It got lowered from age 50 to age 45 in response to the observation that the incidence is rising among young patients. There are multiple ways to get screened. People feel scared about colonoscopy. There's no need. It's a great test, but there are also many, many other ways to get screened. Doing something is better than doing nothing. So definitely explore options with your provider and do something about it.
Do you think they're going to lower that age even further, given how the generation of the 20s and 30s, this is now a more potent issue, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely. So there, a lot of work and research is being done to balance lowering the age with availability of screening, you know, outlets, but also kind of the cost and the societal impacts of these policy changes. But really, the main thing is while the policymakers are studying and making decisions and debating, we as young people can really take charge of ourselves. And when we pay attention to our symptoms, if there is anything, definitely don't delay and get checked out. And that's what I meant by, you know, not delaying any diagnostic tests while the dialogue about screening is ongoing.
Is there any difference in terms of susceptibility by gender or by race?
No major difference with susceptibility by gender. We know that men are perhaps a shade shyer in talking about poop, but please don't. There's no difference in gender. Some races, there is some data to say that African Americans may be at higher risk. And they may get diagnosed a little bit younger, but some of that data is to be verified yet. And I think the main message is that one is never too young, and unfortunately, everyone is at risk.
So, what are the symptoms we should look for?
Great question. Many, actually, of the young patients are asymptomatic. But when there are some symptoms, it could be blood in the stool, rectal bleeding, pain as the stools are evacuated, change in the shape and caliber of the stool. But also, if you're just going to get blood work done and you are somehow found to be anemic. So those are some of the common presenting symptoms for the patients.
So when we talk about prevention, what are the lifestyle changes that are recommended to reduce our risk?
Yeah, so I think that here the focus is really on wellness and self-care. I think when we think of colorectal cancer, we think about gut health. And so making smart choices in terms of what we eat. The diet should be rich in fiber, fruits and vegetables, low in processed food and low in red meat. I know this is not news to the population, but it's really important. Secondly, engaging in regular exercise. It will go a long way in reducing cancer risk overall, but colorectal cancer included. And then lifestyle factors, avoiding smoking, limiting alcohol, and just maintaining kind of an active lifestyle.
If listeners want to learn more and dig deeper into this subject, is there a website they can visit?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So American College of Surgeons has great information on their website, and it's www.facs.org/colorectal cancer in one word.
All right. We want to thank Dr. Nancy Yu for being with us today to shed light on this important topic. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
Solar industry is adding more new power to the U.S. grid than any other technology, helping meet the largest surge in electricity demand since World War II. The U.S. solar industry saw record-breaking growth in 2024, more to the grid than any other energy source has added in a single year in the past two decades. Ohio is a quickly growing state in this movement, ranking 13th in solar, with over 4.7 gigawatts of installed capacity, as well as several new solar manufacturing plants. Abigail Ross Hopper is the president and CEO of the Solar Energy Industries Association, and she joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Thank you. Solar has had such a dramatic impact on the state of Ohio in recent years. What are some of the benefits the state has seen from this movement?
Yeah. Well, you just gave a great introduction sort of nationally about what's happening. Ohio is now the number one state for solar manufacturing in the United States. It's really, it has been an American success story. I know that sounds a bit cheesy, but it's true. you know, in 2017, the first year of President Trump's first presidency, the United States was number 14 nationally, I mean globally. Excuse me, in terms of solar module manufacturing. And in 2024, we were number three. And so that just shows you, like, what a difference kind of policy and demand and driving down costs makes in this. And then Ohio is the number one state, right? The most of these investments have gone to your great state. What does that translate to? That translates overall to about $5 billion invested in the state of Ohio. It translates to about 8,000 of your fellow Ohioans employed in the solar industry. And a lot of that has happened in the last few years, as you said.
So why is solar so important in meeting growing energy demands? Aren't there other sources of energy?
Yeah, there are other sources of energy, and honestly, Jay, we're going to need all of them. As you said, this is the first time since World War II we've seen this kind of growth. And just to be clear, we're seeing it because of the growth of artificial intelligence. We're seeing it because of the growth of domestic manufacturing. We're seeing it because of the growth of data centers. So all things that are strategically important for our nation, right? So the energy demand is a sign, and it's a sort of an element of a national security strategy. And solar is an important piece of that, primarily because we are the fastest to installation. So, you know, it takes a minute to build big infrastructure. And so it takes time to build natural gas. It takes time to build nuclear facilities. It takes time to build solar, but the time to build solar is much faster. It's about 18 months to build the solar project. And so that's why it's crucial that, you know, at this moment, we're in this global race for being the leader of AI, being the leader of manufacturing and other things, that we have all the energy we need at our disposal.
So will the new presidential administration continue to support the growth of this industry in Ohio and the U.S. with tax cuts and incentives as it has been in the past 4 years?
Yeah, you know, I'm very hopeful of that. It is part of my job is to make sure that sort of that there's an understanding of what a critical role solar and storage in particular play in this national security conversation, in this growing electricity demand conversation. I can tell you that under the first Trump administration, solar grew about 128%. And so there is a strong history of this energy, you know, our president talks a lot about American energy dominance, and we give him our full-throated support in that regard, right? And we are part of that American energy dominance. Like, we don't want to give up any of these technologies or opportunities to countries that are not our friends.
For the average homeowner,
yeah,
how much annual savings can be realized by going solar?
You know, it really, I can't give you an exact number because it depends a lot on how big is your family, you know.
Square footage of the house, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Hot showers.
Yeah.
But I will say that, you know, the vast majority of people in Ohio and in the United States that choose to go solar are doing it because they're saving money, right? Like, there are not that many people that choose to go solar because, you know, they think it's going to look nice on their house or because they're, you know, doing it for environmental reasons. They choose to go solar because it saves them money. The other reason, though, is especially as we see more wildfires, more hurricanes, more tornadoes, more droughts, more, you know, fill in the blank. If you add solar and storage to your home, you are now, in those times of outage, you are running your own home on your own power. And so that level of resiliency and that level of security in being able to maintain power, keep your medications cold, right? If you're a diabetic and you're on insulin, you need to keep your medications cold. If you have someone in your home that needs electricity for their medical device, if you are a baby in your home that needs to keep formula cold, right? There's a whole number of reasons why, like, not just for our comfort, which is lovely, but actually for our security, we need to have those resilient homes, and solar and storage can do that.
We talked about homeowners making the change. Do you think that this will also impact the rental market so that apartment complexes and rental homes will also join the party?
Great question. There are a number of multifamily buildings that are going solar for all the reasons we talked about, right? It is, the research shows it increases the value of your property. It obviously makes your property more competitive because you can either, if you as the landlord pay the electricity bill, then obviously it will, that will be savings to you. It makes it more competitive if you're to your rental. To your renters. It is an area in which there has been a lot of growth in the last few years. The other area where there has been a lot of growth is in the corporate sector. And so, you know, some of the ones that get big headlines are the technology companies for some of the reasons we just talked about. But Walmart is a huge, huge investor in solar because think about it, right? They have warehouses and they have stores. So they have huge flat roofs. And they have huge electricity bills because they have to keep everything refrigerated and they have to keep their stores comfortable and they have to keep the lights on. And so companies like that are going solar, again, to save money. And we have seen a huge uptick in that market as well. So the big companies that run the warehouses around the countries, those folks are going solar as well.
For folks that want to learn more about the subject, is there a website?
There is. I would encourage folks to go to SEIA, Solar Energy Industries Association, SEIA.org.
We want to thank Abigail Ross Hopper for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
The word of the week is tariffs. There's been a lot of discussion about their potential impacts on the U.S. economy and your personal finances. Some economists and investors worry President Trump's now paused tariffs on Canada and Mexico, as well as those on China, will lead to a trade war. They quickly led to a tumultuous week on the stock market. But now many of those tariffs are on pause for nearly a month. Let's recap. On Tuesday, President Trump moved forward with 25% tariffs on nearly all goods from Mexico and Canada. He also put an additional 10% tariff on Chinese imports. Then on Thursday, he announced he was pausing tariffs on Canada and Mexico. The stock market has had an unsteady week amidst the uncertainty. CBS News reports that Wall Street analysts say the market reaction reflects investor concerns a trade war could slow economic growth and spur inflation. If the tariffs ultimately go into effect, that could impact the prices we pay for all kinds of goods because businesses will likely pass along the cost to consumers. In his Tuesday night address to Congress, the president did acknowledge the slew of tariffs could cause a, quote, little disturbance. But again, the tariffs are now paused. 10TV's Tara Jabor talked to ordinary Ohioans about their concerns and an economist about the potential impact of tariffs on prices if they go into effect and stay in effect.
We spoke with people in the short north to hear what they think about the tariffs.
A policy that will restrict the growth of the three economies.
Garrido thinks that consumers will pay the price.
This will affect U.S. consumers, given that a lot of the raw products that are consumed by U.S. consumers are produced in these two other countries.
Benton Wishart told us he's most concerned about the cost of gas.
There's going to be large implications for oil and gas and for raw mineral imports.
Ned Hill, a professor of economic development at The Ohio State University, says the first thing people will notice is the increase in price of food.
High demand, high margin foods in the winter that largely grow in Mexico. Say goodbye to your avocados.
Next, gasoline.
The reason for that is that's heavy crude. It takes special refineries to handle it. And guess where they're located? They're in Toledo and they're in Lima.
Hill says a lot of cars have parts that are made in Mexico and in Canada. But he thinks those tariffs will take time for consumers to notice since cars aren't built overnight. Hill worries that if the tariffs last, they could have a long-term negative impact on the economy.
Combined with the layoffs from Washington, an increase in deporting labor from the United States, and large tariff increases, yeah, I think the probabilities of a recession have increased dramatically.
Now again, President Trump has paused many of the tariffs on Canada and Mexico, including the auto tariffs. If they do go back into effect, the tariffs would impact many industries and economic sectors. One of them is the restaurant and food service industry. The Wasserstrom Company is a 120-year-old Columbus-based family-run food service and supply business with clients and customers across the country. The company's products include stoves and ovens, ice machines, pots and pans, dishes and silverware, and many more products. According to Wasserstrom's website, they work with restaurants ranging from fast food to fine dining. And company leaders say they see how tariffs can affect operating costs, the supply chain, and overall business operations. Joining me now is the president of Wasserstrom Company, Brad Wasserstrom. Brad, thank you for being here today. Appreciate it.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Doug.
So we've seen a lot of changes this week just in the tariff discussion and the tariff policy. First, they were in effect, and I mentioned that they were put on pause. What does that kind of back and forth do to your planning purposes and you know the way that you can adjust to what's going on?
It puts a lot of stress on our team, first of all. You can imagine the number of phone calls we're getting from our customers and clients wondering what their pricing will be. They want some certainty. Our team then is reacting to that, calling our suppliers and vendors, but we're not always able to get the answers from them. They don't always have clarity on how the tariffs are going to work. So it's just putting a lot of stress on our team back and forth, getting, when we do get information, getting that into our system so we can enact it as we go through our transactions. And then, of course, there's the implications on costs for our business and for our customers.
With the pause right now, the cost won't be changing immediately, right? But are you still having to plan for the possibility of that happening? Because it's paused for basically a month.
Absolutely. We started getting a few weeks ago price increases from our supplier base. Most of the price increases start taking effect April, May, some all the way out into July at this point, depending on the supplier's amount of inventory existing and what their the item may not be from Mexico itself, but it might have components from Mexico or China, for instance. Mm-hmm. So it might only be a part of the item. So we're having to put that into our system now. So as the price increases come, our system's ready to go. It just creates a lot of work and a lot of chaos.
Yeah. Are you already seeing the price increases, even though tariffs haven't officially, really started yet?
We've gotten the notices. The price increases start taking effect April 1, and depending on the supplier, some of them don't take place until, say, June. But we've been getting notices daily for a few weeks now.
Maybe you can give us an example of how this would play out for your company in terms of the way your products are put together and then ultimately shipped. You have some components or some involvement from the three big countries that have been mentioned this. Can you explain how Canada, Mexico, and China are involved in some of the Wasserstrom products?
Sure. About 40% of our products are coming from one of those countries. And of that 40%, about 80% comes from China. A lot of those products are not able to be sourced in the United States and sometimes nowhere else in the world. It's the only place that really is making it. In an extreme case, you have an item where one part of the component, and this is an actual item, a glass component comes from China, a wood component comes from Canada, it gets shipped to Mexico, where they do an assembly within a metal frame, and it all gets put together there and then shipped into the United States from Mexico. The supplier we get that item from is not sure how the tariffs will work for them. Sometimes it's a little bit more straightforward. The item is something that comes directly from the country, not from others. But adding to the mix then is, in the next week or so, there's another tariff that's been proposed on metal of 25%, and a lot of food service products use metal, especially
stainless steel.
Because
you're talking about like the prep tables, refrigerators, stoves.
Ice machines, even flatware, you know, pots and pans, they're all metal items that would have some piece of tariff on it.
So how does that then end up, you know, you're trickling down, so to speak, from what you do to your customers, who are the restaurants and hotels, and then ultimately from to their customers, who would be, you know, the people who are going to eat?
Sure. Well, the hospitality industry has had a really tough go, especially since COVID. It's always been a margin-tight industry. Since COVID, we've had the labor challenges, rents have gone up, food prices have gone up. Now we're talking about items that they use in their prep and their serving, in their kitchens. We would have to pass on these price increases. We don't have enough ability to not pass those on. The restaurants and hotels, food service, margins are thin there, so they're gonna have to do the same. Our part is only one component, though, for our customers. A lot of our produce comes from Mexico, and you'll have a tariff on that. So as much as we've seen menu prices go up the past few years, and consumers are really feeling that, the restaurants are very reluctant to raise prices, but in a lot of cases, they're gonna have to recoup these costs.
Well, we've seen that with the egg shortage, for sure.
Absolutely.
That's not really related to tariff situations. Can there be a tariff that would be good in terms of, you know, like, targeted tariffs that might protect the industry in some way?
You know, off the top of my head, I'm not sure there is one. I understand the basis for a tariff is to put a level playing field between American producers and those that come from overseas. But a lot of the products in our industry, there is no American producer anymore. Mm-hmm. The products have been completely moved to overseas manufacturing. So in the short run, I don't know if I could come up with a good tariff for our industry.
For your industry.
In the long run, it may work very well. Time will tell. Yeah,
basically, what you're saying is that when people talk about targeted tariffs, that would be for products that are already produced in the United States that, you know, you can get here or they can ramp up production on. But a lot of the things that you're using don't have
And I'm not an expert in other industries. There are certainly other industries where you have American-based manufacturing that could really be helped by this. But an awful lot of our products either come from overseas or the components within the product come from overseas. We could have a refrigeration company here in the United States manufactures their refrigerators here, but they might be buying their metal from, say, Canada or another country. The compressor for that refrigerator might come from China or somewhere else. There's very little in our industry that is 100% able to be made here in the U.S.
So does this pause, though, maybe even if the tariffs are going to go into effect, does it give time for, you know, I guess, you know, the rules to be written and things so that you can, you know, take a breath and understand where this will be and a chance to do the math?
Yeah, the pause will definitely help settle down some of the chaotic nature of what's happened the last few weeks, allow the rules to come into place, allow the factories to understand what their responsibility in these tariffs are and how much they would have to pass on, and then allow us as a distributor to take those increases and figure out what we then have to do for our clients.
Okay. Now, I did mention earlier on, as just changing gears a little bit here, 120 years that Wasserstrom has been around. People may see the retail location as they drive off along I-71.
Yeah.
But 120 years, and it's stayed in the family. How have you been able to do that?
Well, I think there's been a lot
of... Four generations now, right?
I am fourth generation. I have 10 relatives in the business, six of us are fourth generation. I think we've, as a family, made a lot of good decisions over the years, sometimes a lot of lucky breaks. The community's been really good to us. We're very passionate about taking care of our customers and our clients. We treat them fairly, and we make sure that we are solving their solutions, and when there is an issue, we take care of it, and they've embraced us.
How did it grow? I mean, it's, you know, it started off small by your great-grandfather, I guess?
Yeah, great-grandfather started. He had come over as a young child from Europe, and he moved to Columbus and started selling tchotchkes off the back of a wagon. And in the 30s, we opened up our first restaurant and equipment supply store. Got into manufacturing in the 40s and 50s, into wood manufacturing, and then into metal manufacturing. And then in the 60s, fortuitously, Dave Thomas had moved to Columbus, and his second day in town met my father, and they struck up a great friendship. And one day, Dave said to my dad, I'm going to open up a burger restaurant, name it after my daughter, Wendy, and if I'm really lucky, one day I'll have 10 restaurants. And I think there are around 7,000 now. But what Dave taught us was there was going to be this multi-unit chain part of the industry that was going to happen. And we engineered our company to aim towards that. So a majority of our business is chain restaurants. Mm-hmm. But we've never lost sight of that local independent restaurateur that gives a city a lot of its flavor.
Deep connection with Wendy's restaurants.
Absolutely.
That's pretty cool. Brad Wasserstrom, thanks for your perspective, you know, from a business perspective on how this can, you know, impact and ripple out as this all plays out. And we will stay in touch to see how it's going.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug.
All right, take care.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Right now, you can see actual size cutouts of 10TV's Dom Tiberi at 35 Jersey Mike stores in Central Ohio. It's part of a fundraiser for the Maria Tiberi Foundation to end distracted driving. Now through the end of March, a portion of your purchase will go to the foundation. And on March 26th, all sales at those locations will go to the foundation. Maria Tiberi died in a distracted driving car crash back in 2013. She was a senior at The Ohio State University, majoring in graphic design. Now the foundation in her name is working to end distracted driving and save lives. It raises money to donate driving simulators. Those simulators are now in four schools in Central Ohio, and several were donated to the entire Springfield, Ohio community, including the Haitian community, who've had some struggles driving. Well, you can see those cutout versions of Dom in all participating Jersey Mike stores. But right now, I'm joined in person by the real Dom Tiberi to talk about the difference that this fundraising is making. Dom, thanks for coming in to Face the State today.
You know, I never thought in a million years I'd be doing something like this. And obviously, thank you to Jersey Mike. These are raising crucial dollars. You know, when we lost our daughter Maria in 2013, you know, I've been in the news business my whole life, and I knew car crashes were bad, but I never knew at that time that it was the leading killer of our children, age 8 to 24. And then you look at it more, and of all age groups, it's the third leading killer, with heart disease number one, cancers two, and car crashes are three. And,
wow.
You know, I ask you, what's more preventable? And I have said often that as parents and grandparents, we should be screaming that it's not acceptable that in 2025, the leading killer of our children's car crashes.
Tom, you've said to me, we've talked about this, that you know, you've got to keep pushing forward. What else can you do? Well, what else you've done is turn this into this kind of positive thing here. And it's making a huge difference. What does that mean to you?
I wish we didn't have to do it.
Of course.
I wish we weren't in this position. But, you know, I have empathy for all parents out there that have lost a child. And we had a decision to make when our daughter was killed. What do we do? And, you know, the fact that I'm on television, you know, I felt like God gave me a mission, gave my wife and I a mission. We had an opportunity, and, you know, we do this not only for us, we do this for all the other parents out there that are suffering, especially if their child was killed in a car crash. And, you know, the statistics don't lie. You know, 16-year-olds are three times more likely than any other age group to be killed in a car crash. But I want to say something about statistics. Every statistic out there has a name, mm-hmm. has a face, and has a family that's missing them. And for us, it's going on 12 years that we lost Maria, but I promise you, Doug, it feels like it's been 30 seconds ago. And so our mission is to try to help change the culture. I agree 100% with Governor DeWine, who, by the way, lost his child in a car crash.
Yeah, Becky.
And we're all affected by it. And so we decided, as you said, I have a platform, and I'm going to try to do something about it. We initially bought 48 driving simulators, placed them around the state of Ohio, primarily with police departments. And now, as you mentioned, we've opened 4 simulator schools. And we had a bunch of folks looking at them the other day, and they were blown away by them. And, you know, I tell people I'm an advocate for moms and dads. The bottom line is if your parents are in your business, if they want to know where you've been, what time you're coming home, what mom and dad is really saying to your kids is that they love you.
That's right, Dom. Definitely. You're showing love back to the community by doing this. Appreciate you coming in to Face the State today, brother.
Thanks, buddy. Right. God bless you.
Thank you, Dom. You too.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.